I pushed a big, well, it's not even that big. I pushed a big green button, but.
But did you start recording?
Friends with brews. I did start recording.
Well, good.
That's proof. That's proof. That's not proof. It's just a sound.
That's not proof, but we will accept it as proof on this show.
Okay. I have got a disappointment and a repeat in store for you today.
Okay.
I'm starting right off the bat with my beers. Here's my disappointment. And the reason I'm drinking this is because it's the only thing I have in my house that I haven't had on this show before.
Okay. Okay.
People can't see this, although Peter can. But what this is it's a 12-ounce can of Cascade Lakes Brewing Company Pineapple IPA. And when I bought it, I was all excited because I saw the pineapple. I don't know how I missed the IPA. It's literally right there, as big as day.
All capitals.
As big as IPA. And what I was excited by was that it was Cascade Lakes Brewing Company. And I have had this on the show, the Cascade Lakes Brewing Company Salted Caramel Porter. And I really like this. And so what I'm going to do in order to both have a new beer while also not being sad and making myself want to barf is I'm going to drink some of this pineapple IPA for you. I'm going to review it. And then I'm going to switch to the porter. And that's going to be what I'm actually going
to
drink.
To sort of cleanse the palate then.
Yeah, so that I can enjoy myself while we podcast instead of wishing I was dead.
You see, this is where if I was you, you would make some kind of off-color comment about enjoying yourself, but I'm going to let that one slide.
Wow.
I'm just going to pretend I didn't hear a thing.
Peter, I want to remind you that we have a camera on, and you haven't given me your credit card number, so nothing like that can happen.
Touche, Scott. Touche. What are you drinking? Oh, we just talked about what
you're
drinking.
Yeah, we just
what
talked about
drinking?
It. Oh, my God.
What am I drinking?
What have you drunk, you I guess, should be the question.
You once Well, I will tell you what I have drunk, but I'm not going to tell you now because it's not yet been on this podcast, so I'm going to save it for a later day.
Okay, okay.
But I will do... Spoiler, it was non-alcoholic.
Oh, okay.
Today, I am celebrating the return of Schoffelhofer Brewery, but... It is not the grapefruit. You can look closely. You can see this is their pomegranate Hefeweizen beer. Okay.
But how would Schoffelhofer pronounce the word pomegranate?
Well, I guess they would be like pomegranate, which sounds kind of Spanish. Pomegranate or something. I come off with like a Mediterranean accent when I say that word. So
I think what would be more likely is you would say, how do you pronounce pomegranate? And they would stand there and stare at you, and then they would throw you in a prison cell.
Echo, what is the German word for pomegranate?
Granatapfel.
So it's a kind of apple. Got it. Okay. Ground apple, I believe.
Wow.
Anyway, so here we go. Yeah. So this is, and I'm not pouring it. I'm drinking it right out of the bottle because Radler style beers like this are often drunk right out of the bottle. At least they are today.
Canister, what is German for pineapple IPA?
I'm having trouble understanding right now.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. You have a canister?
Are we going to do this again?
One of those.
Okay. All right. I'm going to open my IPA.
It sounds good. I'll give it that. That's probably the best thing about it.
So hoppy. So many hops. Oh my God. Like, why do people like IPA? I feel like you could make any beer and you could be totally off on the subtle nuances of your beer that you're trying to make. And if you make it an IPA and you just overcome it with hops, no one will ever notice. Like, I feel like that's what IPAs are all about. They're easy to make because you just overwhelm.
Bingo. And I must say, that is also the secret of a lot of the non-alcoholic beers I'm drinking. They just are hoppy. There's even one now. It's not a beer. It's called Hop Water, but it's spelled H-O-P-W-T-R. And it's essentially like sparkling water with some, you know, maybe some juice extract or effervescence or, you know, whatever. And, you know, I think the one I got was like... I don't even remember. They added some kind of like, you know, vitamins or something like that. So it's like a vitamin water hoppy thing. But essentially, that's their secret. Now, this has none of that. So I'm going to take the first sip.
Oh, you're drinking right out of the bottle today.
I just said that. You didn't pay any attention. You don't listen to your own show. Yeah,
I didn't. I listen later when I edit. Peter, I want you to know that we missed the pouring sound. So can you please pour some of that on your computer? There you go. Just
pour
the whole bottle right
here. You got the pouring sound.
Okay. I gave my review of mine, which is it has a pineapple flavor that I can barely taste because of the incredible overwhelming yes. sensation of hops, which I do not enjoy. That's my review. My review is I will not never even, drink
what,
that
What if
again.
You were desperate?
Well, I might eat it. I told my wife, let's just use the remainder of this six pack for beer bread or something, because that okay. probably would taste okay. okay.
I get that.
So I'll eat it, but I friggin' won't drink it. So what's your review?
I give this a thumbs up, although it is not as good as their grapefruit Hefeweizen. That's the flagship offering and still definitely superior to this one. The grapefruit Hefeweizen is 2.5% alcohol. This one is 3.2.
Oh my God.
I know, right?
It's almost noticeable.
Mm-hmm. Mm. It's good.
I'm going to open my salted caramel porter already now so that I can have something good to drink. Yeah. No, I told you, I'm just going to sample the IPA so that I can review it for the podcast.
Okay, it's been reviewed.
But I want to actually drink.
Dude, talk about it. Don't call us, we'll call you.
This is the same company. These are two different beers from the same company. At least I'm liking one of them, and I'm purposely drinking it. So they can't get too mad at me. They can be a half sponsor. We've got to get people to sponsor us.
Half sponsors.
Mm. Well, that's good.
They can half sponsor us by sending each of us gets one, you know, we each get a beer, but we don't get the same beer. So that way,
right.
You know, if we each got a copy of, or, you know, a copy, if we each got a copy of the same beer, I'm just going to use that, you know, vernacular, that would be sponsoring sure. the show. But if one of us gets one beer and then that's a half sponsor, I like that. What we're doing now, I believe, has been referred to as reverse sponsorship. We are sponsoring yes. them.
We are sponsoring them, albeit in a manner in which they probably don't notice.
Does that seem
our overall
right
contribution
to you?
Is probably so minor
yeah.
that they don't even notice our sponsorship.
Still.
But you are true.
So we have a main topic tonight, but before we get there, I wanted to ask you a couple things real quick.
Let's talk about your haircut.
Oh, okay. Well, we
but
can
first,
do that too.
Can I comment on your haircut?
Yeah, you
I just want
did.
To say you look good.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
You look very nice.
Yeah, I have been cutting my own hair now for years.
Have you really?
Oh, yeah.
So years even when it was longer than this, you're...
Years.
Oh, you do a freaking good job, my friend.
Years and years. I took a break for a while when I moved to this location, and I went and I tried... I don't know if I tried all of the barber shops within like a mile of my place, but there are like... Mm-hmm. A dozen. I'm not exaggerating. There are like a dozen barbershops within a mile of my place.
Did you do it all in one day? You just had one barber?
One
did
day.
This
it's like just the side, just the side, just
spot.
The top,
yeah.
right? No. But there was like a span of about a year when I just went around and I tried different ones. And I found one that I liked and I would go back there regularly. Sometimes mm-hmm. I would do it myself. Sometimes I'd just go there again. And then COVID. And I was like, well,
yes.
I guess, you know, I don't care. I can, it's just, it's back to me. So this time I decided I was just going to go a little shorter and a lot shorter on the sides.
Yeah.
And so I've got a variable length clipper. And I made this mistake once before. I had one that was adjustable. So it's like you just use your thumb to ratchet up and down. And there was one time I pushed it and I just, you know, pressed it against my skull and it went down to the lowest level. So when that one died, I replaced it and I got another one, which is fixed length. So I have like a dozen different, you know, lengths from like 1 millimeter up to whatever.
Yep. Little guards, yeah.
Right. So I was using that. However, if you have it, you know, positioned so that the teeth, like imagine that it's a garden rake, right? And so you position it so that the teeth are perpendicular to your skull, right? And you rake it along the way, you're at that right angle. But now, if imagine that you're tipping the rake forward so that the teeth are like facing to you and like you're putting the rake in the configuration as if someone just stepped on it and it hit them in the face, right? Well, if you turn it so it's like that and the teeth are parallel to your head, it's a lot shorter again, all of a sudden.
Right. Even with a guard in place over the blades.
Even with a guard.
You can vary the length for a given guard.
Bingo.
Depending on how you angle the clipper.
And so, by accident. Oh, and if you hear dogs barking in the background, that's because my neighbor's dogs are here visiting. So yeah, I ended up giving myself a little bit of a shorter bit than I intended to. And then I was just like, well, you know, let me even it out on both sides. Let me just keep going. Let me just keep, you know what? What? Screw it. And I just went short all the way. And, you know, at first I was like, is it a little too short? Yeah. And then by day two, I'm like, oh, I like this. So I'm happy.
So is that a one or a two on top?
It's a two on top or two to two and a half, two or 3 millimeters on top and one on the side.
Well, I got to say I'm impressed because cutting your own hair is difficult unless you do it like I do. I'm balding, so for my hair, I just take the clippers without any guard. Yeah, I just take the clippers without any guard and buzz it across my head each time. Yeah,
that's next.
But to have normal hair like you do with varying lengths across the sides and back compared to the top, to blend that in can be difficult. So I'm actually impressed because I never guessed before that you were cutting your own hair.
Yep.
Good job.
Yep, done it before. We actually talked about that once on Blurring the Lines, too. Adam was impressed at the fade that I got there. So
Blurring the fade.
So two topics I wanted to cover, not my haircut, before we go into the main topic. That was the latest on GPT and my exploits on that, and text editor / development environment that you're using. So first off, AutoGPT is taking the world by storm. Everyone's saying how it's the best thing and it can automatically, basically, it gives GPT a task and GPT itself decides how to pursue this task. What I managed to do, now I have both the $20 a month ChatGPT Plus subscription, which is unlimited web interface access, GPT 3.5 or GPT 4. And I also have the API access, which is, you know, a fraction of a cent per query, depending on which model you're using, et cetera, et cetera. My usage for the entire month of April had been around $3.60 or so. And the bulk of that was like the first day when I was learning, you know, the API, and I was feeding it like 1 meg PDF files and stuff and saying, you know, parse these and summarize this and read this and blah, blah, blah. Time goes by and I'm at around, you know, like I said, I spent, I think, maybe a dollar or two the first night setting up the API access. Fast forward to a couple of days ago, I started using AutoGPT and I gave it this very similar task that I had given ChatGPT that I had interactively worked with. And the task was, I want you to fetch my email, you know, log in, download my emails, read them all, prioritize them, what's urgent and important, give me those, you know, first give me the urgent important ones, then the urgent ones, then the important ones, then everything else, and ignore advertising and promotional content within the messages, right? And then just, you know, like completely ignore spam and give it all to me like that. And AutoGPT started, it's like, okay, well, to do this, I'm going to research the best libraries for this and that and blah, 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 blah. And it started giving itself all these tasks. And all it was doing was just generating more work for itself. And if I didn't know better, I would swear that it was just, you know, like trying to keep itself busy to bill
activities,
more.
Activities, not results.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah, it's like, I pay for, you know, I'm not paying for results here. I'm paying for lines of code generated or something like that. So AutoGPT, essentially, my first experiment with AutoGPT did not live up to expectations, nowhere near. So instead, I went back to just working directly with ChatGPT again and having it, you know, do some, you know, write some Python code for this, that, and the other. But It didn't take very long before I was going down a rabbit hole of Python troubleshooting where it just didn't know what it was doing. And I'm like, okay, move over. I'll take it from here.
You're telling it what the problem is. When you give it an error message and it's like, here's what your problem is. And you're like, no, it's not.
Well, for me, usually it does diagnose the problem right, but it doesn't fix it. That's what I find.
Oh, I've had it where it's just completely wrong about the problem. And I have to go, and I can tell based on the error message that it's barking up the wrong artificial tree.
Again, it's a tool. When it's good, it's good. And when it's not, it's a hammer. So there you go.
When it's not a good tool, it's a bad tool.
It's a bad tool. So yeah, other than that, you know, I'm still using it. I used it last night during my superpowers campaign. We had a guy got struck by lightning, became a supervillain, and the heroes were investigating what had happened. And they're like, how much are those medical bills? And I was like, so GPT, in my fictional universe, a guy got hit by lightning. He was hospitalized for several weeks before like being discharged and later developed superpowers. What could his medical bills look like? And it's like, okay, let's analyze this. So this guy gets hit by, you know, lightning. We'll call him Lightning Bolt for reference. So Lightning Bolt gets hit and it goes in and starts making out this very plausible thing. Although I thought that the numbers were a little low. It felt to me like he was paying Canadian dollars or something. So subsidized full-on healthcare or something, you know?
Did you ask GPT if it understands the American medical system?
Scott, come now. We know there are limitations to everything, including GPT. No one understands the American medical system.
You're right. I'm sorry.
That's just setting it up for failure.
I was just hoping. Jeez.
So while I've been doing this, I sat down over the weekend to do a couple of, like, you know, get started programming your own GPT stuff just to see what other people are doing out there. One of them looked interesting. It was like a 5-hour course on GPT and, you know, writing your own programs for it. I was like, this is great, except it's all in JavaScript. And I was like, this is crap. Give me one in Python. Of course, the first Python one I found was like 15-minute introduction. I was like, all right, well, what the heck? I'll start here and just take a quick look at it. The reason I bring this up, though, is the first thing the guy does is has you download Visual Studio Code Community Edition and install the Python modules for it.
Yeah.
And that got me thinking. Now, on Linux, I don't have like a Linux workstation right now. So when I'm using Linux, it's usually via a terminal session, SSH, and I use VI as my editor. Okay, fine. On Windows, it's usually Notepad++, but sometimes if I'm going into PowerShell, I'll use the PowerShell, the built-in PowerShell IDE. On macOS, lately, I've been using TextMate as my preferred editor. I'm curious, what are you using as your go-to text editor on Mac and your iPad, and at work if you use that at work?
I have not used TextMate in decades. I do use VS Code, and the reason why is because it has overwhelming plugin support and language server support, and the frameworks that I like to develop in. The stuff that I'm using for my websites currently, which is Astro, the Astro people have amazing language server support for VS Code. And what that gives me is things like I can immediately see where my syntax issues are. I can see when I'm declaring stuff but never using it. I can see all kinds of stuff right off the bat that I might not in other editors. For example, the editor that I really like from a UI perspective and a user experience is Panic Nova. But Nova has not great language server support. It doesn't support the latest language server. And even if it did, it would be a matter of translating what the Astro people have done for VS Code into a version that Nova could use. And frankly, I don't want to spend time getting it to support the tool that I want to use. I just want to use the tool that I want to use. Also, language servers are confusing as hell, and I don't even know how to do that. Like, I started looking into it, and I was like, you know what? This is a waste of my time.
What is language? What's a language server?
A language server is a process that runs that supports a given programming language in order to do things like tell you when you're making syntax errors, do the autocomplete.
So it's like a real-time interpreter kind of thing.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
So if I used Panic Nova, I would be behind in terms of, it would be like more manual. It'd be like the old days. It would be like, well, it's not going to really show you the syntax stuff. You just have to know what you're doing and blah, blah, blah. And that's fine. But the reason why these modern IDEs have developed these tools is because it does make things faster. And in the end, I don't want to spend more time than I need to. That's why even first of all, I do all my stuff locally, and then I move it to my Linux servers. And so far, I've never done anything on my Mac that also won't run on my Linux server. Even Bash scripts, even Python scripts, even Node.js scripts, all that stuff runs without an issue. I've never had to modify it to get it to run on Linux.
Okay.
But besides that, with VS Code, you can connect to the server and just directly edit your files right on the server.
Right, yeah.
And so, you know, if you're actually writing a lot of scripts, that would probably be the better way to do it, because then you'd get all the helpful hints and tools and plugins and stuff like that.
Well, the thing I like about it is having the same editor on every machine I'm working on and not having to, you know, do it. Because, like, when I use the hospital, when I work for the hospital, I'm usually either using a VDI, which is Windows-based, so I'm not going to run TextMate in that.
Right.
Or I'm on, you know, their hardware, and that's Windows, so I'm not going to run TextMate on that. So I started playing with VS Code, and right off the bat, I was like, okay, it's not that bad.
It's not that bad, yeah. It's not the most beautiful user experience, but
No, but it was kind of nice that I was able to do it. And, you know, I grabbed my Linux laptop and I was like, wait, they make this for Linux? Oh, yeah, they do. And I installed it. And I was like, wow, it feels just like it does on the other places. So that's kind of cool. So I was just curious what you're using there, but I might switch to it for a while just to see what it's like, you know, having the same tool everywhere and, you know, keeping the same keystrokes and, you know, menus, et cetera, et cetera. So,
yeah. And I was using Panic Nova for a while and I finally just gave in and said, look, for the stuff that I'm doing right now, I'm not going to beat VS Code. I'm going to waste my time trying to duplicate that experience by manually writing my own integrations, even if I can, even if they would support the latest features, which they don't. And so I finally just said, look, the UI isn't so precious to me that I'm going to give up functionality on this. And so that's what I use. Now, of course, when I'm playing with doing Mac-related stuff or iOS-related stuff, I use Xcode. And I like Xcode. I don't have any problem switching between Xcode for those things and using VS Code for everything else because the Mac and iOS related stuff is stuff that's only ever going to happen on a Mac anyway. So, like, who cares?
Right.
It's kind of its own little world. So the fact that it's segregated does not matter whatsoever.
So I was wondering about that. If, you know, developing for Mac, like, it seems like Xcode is the default. I mean, it's a full-featured platform. It's what you do to use their built-in stuff. So, you know, but I was curious.
Yeah. And even if you used a different editor to actually edit your files, you're going to have to be using Xcode to do a lot of the stuff anyway. So you might as well just use Xcode. The editor is good enough. It understands all the stuff that's going on there. And so why not? But yeah, for everything else, which is mostly what I do is everything else, I use VS Code at the moment. And I do use VI for editing stuff quickly. I do use Terminal, but when I am writing scripts where I want or working on web pages or something where I want, you know, it's more than just fixing something up quickly. Bash scripts I do tend to write in VI, though. That's interesting. I guess I do. But everything else I tend to write in VS Code.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you for that tip down editor lane. Shall we move into our main topic?
Yeah. Peter, when did you start getting into computers? What were your first... This I stole from ATP, by the way. I really enjoyed this week's ATP because they talked about their formative computing experiences. And I got to thinking, my formative computer experiences are most like John Syracuse's of the three of those people. And it made me wonder. I would think that you're different because if I had to guess, I'm just taking a guess here and you tell me if I'm right or wrong. My guess is you did not use Macs or any Apple products at first. You first used PC.
Yep. I have not yet heard the latest episode of ATP, so no spoilers for me.
You'll enjoy it, though.
My first computing experience would probably be when my mom got a Timex Sinclair.
That's interesting.
I don't remember much of anything about it. I remember it did have some games on it. That's probably all I remember. My mom was interested in it, and I think she was... I don't remember what she did with it. At school, we had the Tandy color computers, or the Cocos, as they were referred to, from Radio Shack. And I don't remember what operating system they ran, but like all they could do was BASIC, and they had some games, and these were the games or whatever that you would load off of cassette tape. So the storage was a cassette tape, like that kind of old, you know, cassette. And I was like, wow, okay, that's interesting. Oh, they had Logo. That's right. They had BASIC, Logo, and some other games. And Logo was your first, my first introduction to programming, where you could just basically give the cursor commands. So like pen down, write 50, turn 90 degrees, write 50, you know, and that would draw an L 50 characters or 50 pixels wide by 50 pixels tall, for instance. So played around with Logo a little bit and played around a little bit with BASIC. And then I don't remember how old I was, but my parents bought me the Tandy 1000SX computer. And that did run MS-DOS. It had 384 kilobytes of memory and two, count them, two 5 1/4-inch double density floppy drives. There you go. So that was my first computer. And I do remember that's probably where I got my always wanting to have the latest and greatest, because I remember my mom was really disappointed that we bought that one. And then very shortly after that, they came out with one with like, I want to say a 10 megabyte hard drive. And, you know, so I think ever since then I've like, you know, had like upgrades envy or whatever you want to call it. So,
yeah, well, as they pointed out on ATP, those were the years where you would buy a computer and it would be instantly obsolete because things were changing so fast.
So yeah, times have changed. That's for sure. But yeah, so I had that the Tandy 1000SX. I think that I'm pretty sure that stuck with me, I want to say through high school, though.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you got that?
I don't recall. We'd have to see when it came out. I don't remember. But I'm pretty sure it was the first year that they released the Tandy 1000SX. Let's take a little trip down Google Lane. Tandy 1000SX. Tandy Corporation. Although the one that comes up on Wikipedia shows the black floppy drives. Mine was all white. Okay. 8088 processor, release date 1984. Yep, 38 years ago. Holy cow.
Oh my God. So think about that computer that came out the same year as the original Macintosh.
Yeah. That was 1984. Yeah, exactly.
That's kind of hilarious.
Just think what had would have been different if my folks had gotten one of those instead, right?
Yeah.
So I had that one. Yeah, 84. Yeah, that probably would have lasted me all through high school. And then when I went to college, so I skipped my last year of high school and went straight to college, I bought a Leading Edge brand computer. And it had, if I recall, a 30 meg hard drive. I want to say 30 megabytes. And I always remember that because it had like a meg or so of bad sectors. And that was just something you lived with. You're like, oh yeah, it's not that uncommon. You got some bad sectors. You know, what do you want? You know, what do you want? Perfection? So yeah, I had my Leading Edge computer, and that was the one I did, you know, I started to learn some programming. Well, I did some programming in BASIC in high school. And then, I don't know, do we have a format for this? Am I supposed to just take you up to present, or do we take turns, or how are we, what's the format here?
No, you do your entire thing now. That's interesting. So,
okay.
Early on, when you were using the color computer, which was also called TRS-80 color computer, although
yes,
it wasn't compatible with the TRS-80s that I used in school at my lab.
AKA the trash 80s.
Right. Were you getting into programming right away?
Not in any significant way. Again, you know, very, very little. In ninth or 10th grade, I remember I was taking a programming course and I didn't really get it, didn't really understand it. I was paired with a senior who did most of the work in this class because it was like anyone in high school could take this class, grade 9, 10, or 11, or 12. And he was either 11th or 12th grade now, I forget.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I didn't really get it all that much, but I knew how to use them and I knew how to troubleshoot them. And I was using, you know, like word processors. I knew how to move files around and save them. And I was able to sometimes recover data, just dumb luck. I mean, I didn't have tools or anything like that. But essentially, I was a kid who knew I could troubleshoot like printing problems. And again, you know, most of this was like, unplug it, plug it in again, turn it off, turn it on again. Shocking how much has not changed in the years, you know?
Right, but this probably also came in handy in your household, I would imagine.
Yeah, we had a printer at home. I remember that. Here's something I don't recall was when I first got online.
Hmm.
I do remember getting a trial of America Online because mm-hmm. it was free at the time. They would give you 200 hours, 500 hours, 1,000 hours for free. And I do remember the first thing that I ever downloaded was a picture of Captain Marvel, the now known as Shazam Captain Marvel. So I remember that much. Yes, I remember, you know, searching online. And I was like, wow, you can find comic books and pictures of comic book guys. This is so cool. That was dial-up. Yeah, it has to have been before I went to college. But I don't know for sure, because in college, my first 3 years were at Vermont Technical College, and we had the internet there. I do remember that. We had a whopping 56 kilobit connection, frame relay connection, fractional T or frame, I don't remember, but it was 56K for the entire campus, which fed into the Vermont State College networks. Yes, the Vermont State College networks had an aggregated 384K connection.
Ooh.
Yeah. So if you were at the state, you know, the headquarters of the whole state college network, you had a full 384, which you then metered out to, you know, the little affiliates. And that was, you know, it was simultaneously amazing. Oh my God, the internet just worked. You just sit down at a computer and you're on the internet, and insanely slow because you're sharing it with, you know, sometimes 1,000 people at a time. So that was interesting. It was sometime when I was there, I bought a Zeos brand computer. It's funny, like none of these exist anymore.
I remember
anymore,
that.
Right? Yeah, that was a 486. That was the 486, if I recall.
I liked those.
Well, so I had a Zeos, and I remember that was the time when I was struggling against all odds to use OS 2 as my main operating system, because I was firmly in my anti-Microsoft days. And I recall getting a copy of OS 2 version 2.0 with Program Manager. And that was the big thing. And it's like, it's all object oriented and yada, yada. And it doesn't run any programs. And that was a pain. So I had OS 2. I didn't have 2.0 very long. And then 2.1 came out, Borg. I used that. And then I remember OS 2 3.0, Warp came out. And I remember wanting to strangle the idiots behind the marketing campaign because they didn't get that the whole thing was supposed to be a Star Trek theme. Mm-hmm. So 2.0 was Borg because that was supposed to be the one that was going to capture all the market share. Everyone was going to, you know, get assimilated. Warp version 3, they addressed all of the crappy performance concerns and it was supposed to be super fast. So like warp speed. And instead, these idiots did this rainbow colored, tie-dyed, blurry, weirdo, like, dude, this is totally warped, man, advertising campaign, along with a slogan in the New York City subway where a guy is like a guy in a business suit. He's kind of like looking down, and the quote was, "I think it obliterates the software I'm using." And people thought that warp was a new virus.
Oh my God.
And I was like,
you don't want to talk about your OS obliterating your computer.
It obliterates the software I'm using. That was the quote. And I'm like, these people need to be fired. They need to be fired so hard and never work in this town again. I mean, this is just ridiculous. So I finally gave up on OS 2, tried for a long time. You know, I used Windows 95. Okay, you know, yeah, whatever. But, you know, over the years, I had tried everything. So my first computers, you know, they ran DOS. I ran Windows 3.0 very, very briefly, but I didn't have a mouse. So I was like, I don't understand what is so good about this. You know, I have to learn all these keystrokes to move around, but this is just bizarre. And then I got, you know, OS 2 had the mouse. And I would say, okay, I get it. But OS 2, and again, OS 2's big thing was it would run OS 2 programs, Windows programs, and DOS programs.
Right.
But it never lived up to its claim of being a better DOS than DOS and a better Windows than Windows. And when I had real native OS 2 software, they were terrible. Like Lotus, eventually IBM bought Lotus. So, you know, Lotus AMI Pro was the word processor, and 123, obviously people of our age anyway, know what Lotus 123 was. Mm-hmm. But it was terrible. I mean, the performance on these things, it was just astonishingly bad. And apparently, if you had a machine back then with like 32 megs of RAM, which back then, that's kind of like having a machine today with, say, 32 gigs of RAM, which I got to say, most people don't have, right? You know, most systems these days are probably 8 or 16 and they run just fine. But you had to have like, I guess it's probably more like having the equivalent of like 64 gigs of RAM today.
Yeah, or maybe 128.
Yeah. And if you had that, oh my God, the computer runs amazingly. Well, no kidding. It sure as hell better with that much, you know, power on it.
So it sounds like maybe the issues weren't so much the applications themselves as just the OS bogging the system down, and when you add the applications on top of that, it just doesn't run.
Yeah, it could have been. And, you know, so I went through my OS 2 phases, and then, you know, went to Windows, used Windows a lot. You know, a lot of the early days, though, I basically just used it as a shell for running multiple DOS windows and DOS prompts.
Yeah, but how did it feel going, since you actually used OS 2 quite a bit, how did it feel mm-hmm. going from OS 2 to Windows? Granted, everything functioned, but did it seem like a totally inferior operating system in a lot of ways?
It really didn't. It really wasn't that big a deal for me, you know, like it was an idealistic thing. I was pissed off because I hated Microsoft's monopolistic practices. You know, in hindsight, had IBM dominated the world, would we be any better? I don't know. Probably not. But still, I just didn't like Microsoft for, you know, young, stupid, idealistic reasons, right?
I think we all went through that phase.
Yeah. So, you know, so there was that. And I was firmly that, you know, Macs are for idiots because, you know, they would say things like, oh, they're better. And I would say, okay, why? And they're like, because they're better. And I'm like, you, sir, are an idiot, right? You know, so again, putting all the same logical, you know, thought that you would into an argument that you would today in a, I don't know, political debate. So I didn't really have anything to do with Macs for the longest time. So that was that. And then I got into this thing called networking, which was kind of interesting. Networking, I don't know if you're aware of this, but well, it's pretty cool. It's a technology that allows a problem or a bug on one computer to cause a problem or a crash on another computer. It's pretty cool.
So what you're saying is I need to hang up before you cause me any problems.
No, it's too late. You're already infected.
Damn it.
In college, we had primarily DOS computers my first few years there. And they did have an old AT&T MassComp Unix system. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't useful for much. It was networked, but very few people knew how to like SSH or no, sorry, we didn't have SSH.
It was Telnet.
How to Telnet or RSH into it from another machine. So most of the time we'd have to walk up to it. It had these, you know, oldie schooly keyboards. It had the green screens, which by the way, that's still my default, my terminal setting. I still do green on black by default.
Oh, interesting.
Yep. You know, so I learned, you know, the basics of Unix there. After I graduated from Vermont Tech, I went on to pursue, but did not actually complete, a bachelor's of computer science at Clarkson University. And I get there, and it was like, oh, this is what real internet is like. Oh, this is what a real computing center is like. Oh, this is what a real school is like, right? And, you know, they had everything. They had internet in the dorms. They had internet in all the buildings all across campus. They had fast computers. They had a help desk. They had, you know, everything you could want. It was great.
Was that their marketing campaign? Clarkson, a real school.
No, but it could have been, as far as I was concerned, right? And so I started in as a junior there. So they transferred. They took all my first 2 years, you know, credits and transferred in. But still, I was transferring into a comp sci major from computer engineering / electrical engineering technologies.
Right.
So it was different. Now, luckily, I had had a brilliant programming teacher. So he had instilled in me all of the fundamentals. But there was still, like, I was the new guy there. You know, I was the transfer student. And in all of my classes, whether it was the one on, when there was one called Programming Languages, which really was just like a sample. There was like a part of the, you know, like the first quarter was going to be on functional programming with Lisp. Uh-huh. The second quarter was on logical program with Prolog. And the third section was object-oriented programming with Smalltalk. And then another one, it was like, oh, you're going to be in, you know, whatever, software development 2 or something, because you've had the equivalent of 1. Well, they didn't really have the equivalent of 1, right? Because they assumed not that you were covered, you know, you covered all of the topics and the concepts and knew how to compile code and stuff. They assumed you were in last year, you know, last semester, you were in this very predecessor course,
right?
Which I was not. And so that kind of was tricky for me to navigate. And halfway through the semester, I was failing half my classes. That was not a pleasant experience. I didn't really care for that at all. And I did manage to turn it around. So I did come out with high B's and A's at the end of the semester. So, you know, coming from nosedive to pull it up to more than just level off and brushing the tips of that mountain, I was pretty happy with it. But I was unimpressed with the whole experience overall. So I was like, I'm going to take a semester off and think about this, because I wasn't liking it, you know, and I was like, I don't know what I want to do with my life, but this is not fun. So I took a semester off, and while I was there, the local vocational center said, we need a substitute teacher. And I was like, okay, sure. Like, we have this. So the vocational centers are, you know, a lot more like hands-on, less theory, more practice stuff.
Right.
So as it turns out, they had a network of DOS and Windows computers and a Novell NetWare server, which, by the way, was the same exact setup as Vermont Technical College just up the street, where I had been less than a year prior. So I was like, oh, okay. So I spent 3 days there as a sub. And what had happened was the previous computer tech teacher was 1 year away from retirement.
Mm.
The teacher's union had failed to negotiate an acceptable contract. So he just said, screw it, and walked away.
Bye-bye.
This was like 2 weeks into the new school year.
Oh.
This guy that he left.
Wow.
So pretty much left these, you know, kids high and dry without a teacher, without a mentor, and they were not too thrilled about that. So it was a bit of an uphill battle.
Presumably they're paying money to learn something.
Well, the taxpayers were paying money, but yes,
okay,
you know,
sure.
The kids weren't paying a damn thing. Yeah, so I took that, and then, you know, that's when I really started to learn, you know, more about networking, you know, and applying a lot of stuff that I had learned in theory. And this is where I realized that I was much happier actually doing and applying knowledge rather than just all this theoretical mumbo jumbo. That was just not my thing. So I was a lot happier actually putting stuff into production, and I learned that, oh, wow, I really do learn well by teaching and demonstrating. You know, so I made up a curriculum like on the fly, started teaching these kids basic. The ones who were really picking it up fast, I would start teaching C. I didn't talk about this, but, you know, like C and C++ was really my default language. That was the one I learned because I was like, oh, braces are cool. I like these. So much more powerful than basic. Okay, cool. I'm going to do this.
I did like C.
Yeah. You know, so I did that for a couple of years teaching there, you know, understood, you know, learned things. I still had a lot of growing up to do, though, because I was only 21 and I was teaching kids who were literally like 4 years younger than me in some cases.
Yeah.
So that was also a difficult, you know, environment, and I didn't want to be there all that long.
What do you mean? Why was it difficult? Do you mean in terms of commanding their respect?
Yeah. Exactly. Try teaching a bunch of 18-year-olds when you're 21.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
true.
Is that right?
If they were a couple years younger, it might be better, but...
Yeah. So, you know, I was like, okay. So at that point, then shortly after that, the network administrator at my alma mater, right back up the street at Vermont Technical College, quit. An opening was there, and I applied, and I got that job. So I came back to Vermont Tech, this time as an employee.
Not a real school.
Not a real school, but, you know, and not a real network. But I ran that not real network. So I ran the Novell NetWare.
Novell NetWare, not a real network.
Not a real network. So I ran that for a couple of years, and then I started moving on to, you know, my own consulting business, et cetera, et cetera. And the rest is history. But that's my early computing years.
I am actually fascinated that you spent so much time trying to make OS2 work.
Yeah.
Obviously, I know of OS2, and I've known people that have played with OS2, but most people, it was kind of a tangential thing that nobody really got into, so that's pretty cool.
And the funny thing about it is OS2, I believe, is now still... Oh, no, okay. It's not still a thing. The latest release was over 10 years ago, so never mind. It was rebranded as Ecom Station.
Oh, really?
Yes. So, that's interesting. I never had anything to do with Ecom Station. I heard about it once, and by that time, I was so over it, I had moved on.
I did too, but I didn't realize that that was OS2. Huh.
Well, anyway, what about you?
Well, I was a little bit different. I did start on the Apple path early because when we lived in Japan, my brother started getting into computers. And at first, it was kind of a generic computing experience. Of course, the Japanese had all their own brands of computers, and I couldn't begin to tell you what they were now. But they, I don't even know what OSs they ran, but they ran some, as far as I know, most of them ran some proprietary OSs. But anyway, we would go to like computer stores and play games on those and stuff. And then my brother made friends, I think, through a church or something. My brother made friends with a guy who worked at IBM.
Right.
And this guy and my brother, he was older than my brother by far, but he was a nice guy, and he was probably bored as hell with both church and job, whatever he was doing. So he started bringing parts to my brother and talking to him about how they worked. And my brother would scrounge stuff from him and build these like homebrew computers that he would then program in, you know, basically in binary and hex, you know, machine language, that type of stuff.
Real hacking stuff, man.
Yeah. I remember one computer my brother made where you had to program it by pushing buttons, literally entering ones and zeros. It was crazy. That was just an experiment. That wasn't meant to be more than just an experiment. But anyway, my brother started really getting into it. And then at some point, he got an Apple II clone. That was when Apple II clones were a thing.
Yes.
And we played a lot with that. And that's really where I started getting into it, because we had all the computer magazines with all the code listings and stuff. And so what he would do is he would let me play with his computer if I would take the magazines and I would start typing in code for games.
You were his coder.
I was his game entry machine. That's right. I was his game input device.
Someone else has mentioned something like this before. I've heard other people talking about that. Or was it you? Maybe it was.
Have you mentioned
this on another podcast?
Or this one. I don't remember. Yeah. But because I was telling you, that's where I actually really learned how to type.
Got it.
Yeah.
I'm amazed today at, well, I shouldn't be. I shouldn't be at all. People don't know how to type.
No, they don't. That's very true. They don't know how to touch type.
Yeah. And that is, anyway, I don't want to derail, but anyway, continue, please.
Without denigrating this person, I'm just using it as an example because you brought it up, but I actually know somebody who's written apps and done programming who doesn't know how to touch type, and I just find that mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, then when we came back to the United States, an unfortunate thing happened. We went through customs, as one is wont to do when one comes from one country to another and lands at the airport and they have customs, and Apple II clones are illegal. And Apple wasn't happy about Apple II clones, and so Customs took his computer away.
Ooh.
So we started using computers at the library a lot. The library had different Apple IIs and some IBM PCs, but I ignored those and used the Apple IIs. I played a lot of Sierra games. I played a lot of, the name just went out of my head. I remembered the name of this earlier, but what was the command line ones, all the command line ones? Was it Broderbund?
Broderbund, I think. I don't remember who wrote, but are you thinking Zork or something else?
I don't know. There were a whole bunch of command line games from this one company, and I'm trying to...
Zork and Rogue are the ones that come to mind. Rogue wasn't command line as much as it was ASCII graphics.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I've not tried this, but apparently if you want to play Zork, you can tell GPT to let's play Zork, and it'll be Zork for you.
Infocom. Infocom did a lot of those. I did a lot of Infocom games too, yeah. So then at some point, the Mac came out in 1984, and I would go to, first of all, I would read all the brochures and everything. I had Mac brochures. I had the first edition of Macworld. I had all this stuff, and I was just infatuated with the Mac. Because I could see that that UI was so superior to anything that currently existed. I wasn't thinking about the fact that those computers didn't really provide you with a way to program right out of the box, that they were kind of a closed system in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I just wanted one of those. And at some point, somehow, my dad managed to scrape together enough money to buy me the original 128K Mac, and he bought himself one as well. Those computers were like $3,000? I don't remember. $2,000, I think, in 1984. Maybe more. $2,500? I don't remember. A lot of money.
A lot. I mean, mine, I forget. I think the 1000SX was $1,200. I think that's what the website said.
Which is still a lot of money. And so we got those, and we did the traditional Macintosh 128K experience where all they had was a single floppy, which was not the type of floppies that you were talking about, the 5 1/4. These were the 3.5 or the 3 1/4? 5 1/2, 3 1/4? Anyway, whatever, you remember.
3.5, 5 1/4.
Yeah, and so I think it was a 400K floppy that later became 800K with the Fat Mac.
I remember that. The Macs had different capacities because So the 3.5s on PCs were 720 if they were double density, and 1.4 megs if they were high density. And the others, the little guys were 128 and 256K, I think? I don't remember the 5 1/4s.
Storage. It was the single-sided 3.5. Yes, it was a single-sided 3.5-inch floppy of 400K. I think when the Fat Mac came out, the Fat Mac went from 128K of RAM to 512K of RAM. That was a later upgrade. And we did get that upgrade as soon as it came out. And that gave us the 800K drive. But originally with the 128K Mac, there was no hard drives. All there was one floppy drive, which was 400K. And so you did a lot of disk shuffling. It was crazy. It was insane because the application and the data both wanted the disk drive at the same time. So you'd just be swapping things.
Speaking of disk shuffling, when I first installed OS 2 version 2.1, it shipped on, I believe, 19 or 20 floppy disks.
That's insane. What was the capacity of those 5 1/4 inch?
I think those were 1.4 megs.
Already? Oh, okay.
Yep.
So that's way better than what the Mac came with originally. Well, you got to remember, well, obviously just by saying the fact that it was 3.5 versus 5 1/4, they were smaller disks. And the fact that they were only using one side initially meant they were 400K. But yeah, so we did the Fat Mac upgrades, which were expensive when that came out. And then we finally did the Mac Plus upgrade. And the Mac Plus upgrade gave us the ability to put hard drives on our Macs, Peter. And these were SCSI hard drives because this is Apple.
Oh.
So a 20 megabyte hard drive cost $800. And again, somehow my dad managed to find money to buy two of those things. Crazy. You know, I appreciated what he was doing at the time, but not nearly as much as I appreciate it now looking back at it. That's a lot of freaking money. But on that Mac with its black and white screen, I played things like Lode Runner. I think my dad got into Prince of Persia at some point. I can't remember when that came out. Oh my God, there were lots of other games I played that I don't remember now. But let's see. So that was after high school for me. And then at some point, I kept using that Mac because I couldn't really afford another computer. So the Mac Plus upgrade was the last thing that ever happened. And I think that was a megabyte of RAM and a 20 megabyte hard drive and the 800K floppy and whatever operating system it was running at the time. And that was all the upgrades that computer ever got. And I did not get another computer for myself until 1994 when I got my first PC. And that was a Pentium 60. And that was, I think it was a Packard Bell labeled thing. I'm not sure what it was. I got it at a discount through my job anyway. And that was my introduction to DOS and Windows 3.11 for workgroups. And I found a friend who had a lot of software, and I copied a lot of software. And I had been on America Online on the Mac previously, and I had an America Online account. But once I got my PC, my brother was like, look, forget about America Online, get on the internet. So I got on Netcruiser. And that was a big, that was a big, easy to use, integrated, you know, internet experience. It kind of had an integrated piece of software where all your email browsing and all that was kind of in one application, kind of with different functionality. And so Netcruiser was my first internet experience. And then from there, I started using local ISPs. There were so many of them. I can't even remember the names of all of them. One of them was Easy Street, but I can't remember a lot of my local ISPs. So after that PC, I started building my own PCs. And like I could get certain computer parts cheaper through work, and then I would, you know, buy. And somehow my PCs always wound up costing about $3,000. Don't ask me how, which is a lot of money for a PC.
That's how much computers cost.
And so I would build my own PCs, and then I went through the various Windows versions as time went on. Windows 95 was a big one. Windows 95 for me was interesting because I also still had the Mac. I think I was still playing with the Mac at the time, but that was when I completely gave up the Mac. And that was when my brother gave up the Mac for a while too, because the Mac operating system at that time was stuck in limbo. They were trying to come up with Copeland. They were failing. They hadn't purchased Next yet. They did not have a multitasking operating system.
Right.
They had an old creaky thing with lots of weird extensions that was falling apart. And then Windows 95 came out. And by comparison, Windows 95 was so much better. And that's when my brother threw away his Mac and got into PCs. And that's when I really got into PCs as well, when I really started using them more than just goofing or dinking around on them. And I would build my own PCs. I went through Windows NT, Windows XP, Windows 2000, all the different Windows. Well, of course, Windows 2000 before Windows XP, but I went through all the different versions of Windows. And I played around with ASP.NET programming and SQL Server and all that. I'm not saying I was any good at it. I wasn't. But I ran a Windows Server. I played with them. I could do passable, slow programming in ASP.NET. And then at some point, I became curious about the Mac again. And in 2004 or so, the Mac Mini came out, or I don't remember what year it came out. But anyway, there was a PowerPC Mac Mini. It was a G4. Mm-hmm. That was my first return to the Macintosh, was a PowerPC G4 Mac Mini.
Okay. And
because I could hook that up to my existing monitors, keyboards, mice, all that other stuff. And I thought, I'm just going to play around with this. But I liked it so much.
So the Mac Mini was introduced apparently in 2005?
Was it?
Yeah.
That can't be right.
The original Mac Mini. I thought it was sooner than that. I thought it was 2004.
I thought it was 2004. It must have been 2005.
Well, Wikipedia says it was January 22nd, 2005 with a PowerPC G4 CPU.
Oh, early 2005. Okay.
Yep. Coincidentally, that was around the time when you and I met.
Yeah, because that's when I started Dual Boot Radio podcast. Almost immediately. Very shortly after that. Which was a terrible podcast, and thankfully it doesn't exist anymore. But
it brought us together.
It sure did, and for that I'm thankful. I'll take the shame of that podcast if it brought Peter Nicolaitis into my life. So anyway, at that point I started kind of getting back into the Mac. I liked it. I think it was Tiger at that point. I believe that Tiger was the first version of Mac OS I used. I can't remember. Maybe it was Panther, but I thought it was Tiger. Anyway, I started getting into it. I really liked it. I said, you know what? I want to get my wife a Mac because I'm tired of supporting Windows for her. And so we switched to Mac. I don't remember what Mac I got her to begin with. It must have been a Mac Mini or maybe it was a laptop. I don't even remember anymore. At some point I got, when my first Apple laptop was, I believe, a MacBook Pro. I don't think I ever had a PowerPC Mac laptop. So I never had any PowerBooks, but I had a MacBook Pro, and I don't remember if it was the first version or the second version of the MacBook Pro that I had. After that, I went through several MacBook Pros. Then I've had several Mac Minis. I've had a couple of different iMacs. I had one Nehalem Mac Pro giant cheese grater thing that my brother gave me. Basically for my own personal use, I've been on Mac ever since. But I do work with Windows computers at work. I help install servers. I help image them. I help do some server related stuff. I'm not the genius of the group, but I do get to work on those things. And of course, my PC that I use for work is 100% Windows and Microsoft. So, but that's basically it. For many years, I went away from Apple completely and was 100% PC and Windows. And then once I started getting back into the Mac, I realized, wow, OS X really did change things quite a bit. And to be honest, I think I got back into it at the right time because I think that's when, around the Tiger time is when OS X really started picking up steam, I think.
Yes. Yep. OS 10.2 was Jaguar? 4.
Yeah, I think so. 10.4, Jaguar. I think was...
Yeah.
10.4, I think was Tiger. So I don't remember what 10.3 was.
Lion.
No.
Was Lion
Panther.
Because 10 point...
No, it was Panther. Lion came after Tiger.
Okay, Lions, Tigers, Bears. They never had Bears, though, huh?
No, they've never had a Bear.
So I bought my first Mac in 1996, and it was an iMac, because when it dropped under $1,000, I was like, okay, I'll check these things out.
Was that one of the white ones?
Bondi Blue, my friend.
Oh, that kind of iMac. Oh, yeah. Of course it would have been. Oh, that's right, because that's when Steve Jobs came back. That was the first iMac, yeah.
Bingo. Yeah. So I was using that for a while, and I actually started to like it, and I started to make it my primary computer.
That was the old Mac operating system, too.
Oh, yeah. It was Mac OS. I started on, I want to say...
8 point something?
I don't remember. I think it was 8.6.
Yeah.
And then I had a mishap. I fell in Aikido class and shattered my collarbone and was laid up on the couch, but I could still do consulting work as long as I had a laptop. So I bought myself a PowerBook. So I had a PowerBook for a long time.
And what CPU was in that at the time?
I believe the first one I had was a G3, uh-huh. And I had so many problems with it that after months and months and months, they replaced it with a G4.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I was pretty happy with that. I was like, okay, I wish I hadn't had to go through with all this, you know, crap, but I was happy with the replacement. I do remember the transition to Mac OS X being...
bumpy.
Yeah, not smooth. OS 10, right?
It wasn't smooth, but it sure saved the Macintosh.
Yeah. I mean, the first version, though, was like, it was horrible. And then
pretty limited.
And apparently, I guess the first version, you know, when it first came out was like, I guess the reason it was so damn slow was it had like just tons and tons of debugging code, which they like refactored and pulled that out. And that's like why 10.1 was so much faster than 10.0.
Wow. I didn't realize they left that in for the production release of 10.0.
That's the story I heard. So, and again, this is back then I was reading trade rags constantly, you know, like PC Magazine, PC World, and Info World. Now, there was another one too. There was another big, like, you know, newspaper style. That was Info World.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that.
And there was another one that I got every week. And those are, you know, that's how I kept up with, like, I was hearing about all these terms and stuff, but not actually using them. But I knew, like, there's a thing out there called XML, and people are using it for standardizing documents.
Same here. And it was so mysterious.
You know, middleware and, you know, like hearing about all kinds of different things. And there's this thing called Banyan Vines. And when I first stumbled across a client who had Banyan Vines, I was just like, oh, yes, I know we can migrate you to NetWare from this, for example.
By the way, one of the things that I didn't talk about, I somehow skipped over, was that when I was in college, I was actually taking electronics at the time, but the electronics lab actually had a NetWare network set up, and the teacher taught me how to do a complete NetWare install and how to manage it and all that. So I actually did play with NetWare somewhat. Yeah. I don't remember any of it now, but at the time I did, and I thought that was interesting. But yeah, that was hilarious to me when you were talking about NetWare. I was like, yeah, I remember that.
Oh, I went through the whole CNE, Certified Netware Engineer training, back before it was Certified Novell Engineer. They changed it, you know, because it was like, oh, there's Certified Netware Engineer, and then it became Certified Novell Engineer on Netware.
Yeah.
So that was back in the Netware 3 days, and then I got certified in Netware 4, and then Microsoft Windows NT just came along and just ate its lunch.
It's kind of funny because back in those days, knowledge was so much more hidden, and sometimes on purpose, sometimes not, but you just didn't have the internet to go just do data dumps into your brain with.
Yeah.
And so learning stuff was a lot harder. And now when I think about it, it's just hilarious. It's like the rate of learning stuff has just increased exponentially. For all of its faults, the internet did give us that, and you can just learn so much more, so much faster now. It's just unbelievable. It's weird to think back on, even though most of my life was without internet. Is that true anymore? I'm not sure. But anyway, even though a lot of my life was without internet, I still forget how inconvenient and how slow and how tedious it was to learn things, get drivers, get software, all those things that we totally take for granted now without any...
Oh my God.
Without even thinking about it. Those were all major operations at that time.
Having to get getting a software update was like, oh yeah, you can contact them, you know, contact the manufacturer, they can mail you disks.
Right. You had to find out, you somehow you had to find out that there was an update available.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, just, it was amazing. And sometimes, you could download stuff via bulletin board systems.
Right.
You
know,
dial into our BBS and you can download. And like the big companies, you could always dial in and get through. And that was amazing. But most BBSs were busy all the time.
So, right. Yeah. And I remember local BBSs were a thing. We did those. And then when we started trying to use the services, then you could rack up bills big time, because not only did the services charge a lot of money, but if they didn't have a local number, that would cost you. So then you'd be paying long distance fees.
Yep.
It was infinitely more difficult and more expensive to be online at that time.
Yep.
In ways that you can't even think of. What was your first actual high-speed internet? Because I had, my first one was when I came back to Oregon. I got an ISDN line and I managed to bond two channels to get 128K. And I was paying a fortune for that. Oh my God, that was so expensive. And then at some point we got, and then finally Comcast cable was my first one. I always was trying to get at home, but they never came here. But then Comcast finally brought cable to this area.
So we had these things. Let me see if they're still around. I am pretty sure they were called a net ramp, but now that is an ISP in Australia. But I had these things called net ramps, which supported two or three dial-up connections. And they couldn't really bond them like an ISDN line, but they faked it so that you could have these, you know, like two simultaneous 56K dial-ups and say half a dozen computers behind them on Ethernet. So when I wanted to go online, I would. And we had like one was, they were set to dial on demand.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell when things were getting a little slow because the second line, you hear the second modem dial up. And, you know, for a small office of like four people or so back in the early 2000s, this was great. But my first, I don't remember the exact time. I believe Comcast, back then, no, it was Adelphia Cable. Before they went bankrupt and got gobbled up, Adelphia came to town, and I think that was after. Yeah, I think prior to that, though, I was trying to lobby. So the local internet provider, it's now First Light Communications. It used to be Sovernet, which was originally the Southern Vermont Network. Sovernet, right? When they had established, you know, basically when they covered the entire state, and then in other parts, you know, other adjacent states, they renamed it to Vermont's Sovereign Internet Connection.
That's what I thought it meant when you first said that. I was like, oh, brother.
I know, but this is kind of stupid, you know, stuff that matters in Vermont, you know? So I remember working with a guy who just could not sell. Like he said, for instance, you know, if you could get X bandwidth committed from businesses in town, we will bring a T1 line into town and then we will resell a DSL connection. And back then they could not do, there was ADSL and there was also SDSL. Now they didn't have the equipment to do ADSL, but what they could do was drop a switch and a bank of SDLC modems into someone's basement, and that would become their local point of presence, their local POP. Yours truly was
the basement,
the host of that point of presence. I provided the basement. And so I remember, though, like saying they needed to get, I want to say, like, I don't remember, four clients, you know, committing to, you know, X bandwidth. And I made, like, I said, okay, so I told the guy, I said, well, I just made two phone calls, and I now have three clients. And the guy's response was, well, that's good, but we need at least four clients. And I was like, you son of a bitch. I literally just picked up the phone and in the span of 10 minutes have done 75% of your job for you, and you won't make the effort to bring your internet into my hometown.
Find one more guy.
The next day, I got a groveling apology, and I was informed they were going to commit to bringing it to my hometown, even only on three. And within the span of a week, they had way exceeded their requirements. But I remember being so livid. I was like, you can't even, like, dude, literally in 10 minutes, I've done your fucking job for you. As a result, though, I had a T1 line to my basement.
How many people were you sharing that T1 with?
It wasn't a ton. And we never had, you know, bandwidth problems as a result. So it was pretty handy.
That was some pretty crafty entrepreneurship on your part there, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, that's about as crafty as I get, unfortunately. But as a result, you know, I had that there, and I also made my own little hosting business as a result there. That's how I got into hosting.
Oh.
Boy, do I regret that. Because I'm pretty sure I'm probably still hosting some websites that I was hosting back then.
Yeah, but they're paying for themselves, aren't they?
Yeah. Oh, no, they're paying for themselves. But, like, this was back in the day. Like, okay, remember, this was in little old Bethel, Vermont. Very rural. Not the most reliable power situation.
Oh, sure.
Power outages were a regular thing, and all you could do was sit there and hope that the batteries would hold up, because I didn't have any space to put a generator. Not the wisest choice, you know, but hey, you know, I did that for a long time, and you know, the hosting division of Paradigm still exists today. It's just not in my basement anymore.
No, it's in someone else's basement.
It's in a lot of basements.
I don't remember. I never used any hosting services for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really remember in those early days what outsourcing hosting looked like.
Well, I remember using some terrible hosts. I don't remember. There was one that was pretty good. The bandwidth was always good and their servers were solid, but they had no process for things. And so, not unlike my hosting attempts, like all of the updates when you go to add a new website and stuff were all done by like some dude logging in and modifying an Apache config file.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like every time I would add a new domain, the sites would all go down because these numbnuts didn't check to make sure the web server restarted properly, you know. So I eventually gave up on these guys. And then I found out like there was this one called 9 Net Avenue out of New York, right down somewhere in the city, probably New Jersey, but they said they were in New York City. And they were like $9 a month unlimited hosting. And or maybe it was $99. I don't remember, but it was amazing, right? And I remember signing up for them, and they were the absolute worst. The worst. And I remember, I am not making this up, one night, it was a weekend, like a Friday night, my sites were down. I called tech support. The phone just rang and rang and rang and rang and rang and rang and rang. And then I heard the phone get picked up. I heard the sounds of video games in the background, like Galaga or Galaxian, and they hung up the phone.
Oh my God.
And I was just livid. This company also, I don't remember, they got bought out by someone else, and you know, they went away. But they also, I remember, like, they had, it was unlimited hosting. You could have like as many domains as you wanted, but you had a fixed storage space, right? So it was like 100 megs of storage or something like that. Except your log quota counted against that too. So your hosting was in one space and your logs was in the same partition, right? So that would fill up. They wouldn't let you delete your own logs.
You're kidding.
Right. So my available space got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller over time. So I remember going through a ton of lousy, you know, ones. And now, like, my hosting is all scattered across, you know, Linode and AWS, depending on the application.
I do remember when I was in my ASP.NET phase doing that kind of stuff, I was using a web host that was in Florida, and I can't remember the name of them. I loved them so much. I can't remember their name to this date, but they had ASP.NET hosting. There weren't very many at the time that would do ASP and ASP.NET hosting.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved these guys. I can't remember. Oh, I don't remember anymore. I can't believe I forgot their name. And then at one point, I thought I wanted to do Ruby on Rails for some stupid reason because it was...
I remember those days.
Yeah, it was the thing du jour. And I looked for different Unix hosts for that. And I found one that was basically what you described. They were more mm-hmm. friendly than that. And they didn't hang up on you. And they weren't playing games as far as I knew. But they would take forever to get back to you on anything. And I realized I don't want these guys. And at that point, I didn't care about Ruby on Rails anymore. And I went through using a lot of different... WordPress things on different web hosts, and now I'm out of that, and I have a couple of Linode servers, which, by the way, Linode just increased their prices 20%. They got taken over by who bought Linode? Yes, 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 yes. which might be good, it might be bad, I don't know. The one thing I like about Linode is it's one of the few old school, here's your Linux server, put whatever you want on it type things. They're not trying to be an edge. They're not trying to do things like Netlify and some of the others that have these weird services that can get in your way, even though they can make things really fast. And I just want to set everything up myself and do it my way. And it's part of the enjoyment for me. And anyway, I hope Linode doesn't price itself out of existence for me because I kind of like it. But
yep, they're for getting started, they're so much easier than AWS. You know, they just,
yeah,
they're, it's, and they're, and it's a good product. It is absolutely a good product. So, you know, their offering is nowhere near the same as AWS, but if you compare Linode to EC2, direct comparison, you know, it's a fairly good comparison. And, you know, you may be paying a little more, but that's the convenience, because AWS is not for beginners. You know, you've got to invest some serious time to really understand it and dig into it. Now, if you do, there's huge trade-offs, but not everybody needs those.
How many times have people had data on AWS and left it exposed to the internet? It seems like it happens all the time.
S3 buckets, man. That's finally not the default, though. They changed that so it's not the default. And I think, if I remember correctly, they're going through like proactively and locking them down, I don't remember now. I could be just imagining that part.
Way better for people to suddenly find out they can't access something that they should than to have it the other way around.
Yep.
Because they can fix that problem. Anyway, I'm sure there's so much stuff, Peter, that I used to do and used to like and was part of my computing experience that I just can't even remember anymore. I don't know why. I'm not a person that remembers the past very much or thinks about the past very much. But when ATP was talking about this topic, I thought, my experience is quite a bit like John Syracuse's. And so I thought it'd be fun to talk about. You'll like that episode when you listen to it, by the way. They spend almost an hour on that one topic alone, so.
We spent more than an hour. This is a long one. So I think we should stop while we're ahead.
I think we should stop while we're ahead before the listeners get completely tired of us.
So, dear listeners, if you want to find us, well, let's be honest. You know how to, because you're listening to the freaking podcast. But in case you've forgotten, you can find us at friendswithbrews.com. That's BREWS. Scott is on Mastodon at app.net.net/@. Help me here.
APPDOT and then a literal dot and then NET.
/@.
Scott AW.
Scotta. Yes. Okay. Got it. And I am, it's easiest to find me at pn72.com there. That way you don't have to spell Nicolaitis because people have hurt themselves trying to do that. And with that, Scott, I think it is time. I think it is past time that we push the big red button.
Tell your friends.